Hey, good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable, and welcome to Monday morning. It's the 17th of March. It's our panel discussion, and couldn't be more thrilled. We bottled all the stuff up over the weekend, and now we have, we're full to bursting to tell you about our thoughts on the various issues and discuss what's going on in our complex and complicated world. It is St. Patrick's Day, and which used to some reason mean a lot to me, and now I find it vaguely annoying because I feel like I should do more than I do on that day, but I just do like my Irish thing every day, so it's really not that big of a deal. I will say that on Friday in the office, though, I received a big box of bourbon and vodka, and I thought, oh, someone is helping me celebrate St. Patrick's Day. Isn't that nice? So it turned out to be from my buddy Dave Gustina, and it made its way to my office. And so the reason I'm telling you this, panelists, is that in case of emergency, we can break this bottle open.
I'm betting by 9:25.
That's right. Yes. Unfortunately, George, Mark's son, will not be able to participate unless his parent and guardian allows him to. But I don't know. Good morning, all. Welcome. It's an absolute delight to have you here on St. Patrick's Day. Later on today, I'm going to be in South Hadley, Massachusetts, and talking to Emma Donoghue, who is a wonderful Irish novelist whose new book is about Paris. It's about the Paris Express, and you've all seen that picture of from, I think it was 1895, where the train, the Paris Montparnasse station, where the train just blew through the train station and is just sort of dangling over in the street. She writes about how that happened, and it's a historical novel. It's brilliant. It's so good, and we're going to be talking about that this afternoon, 5 o'clock, at the Odyssey Bookshop in South Hadley, Massachusetts, and you can find out more by going to odysseybks.com. I do think they have a sign-up sheet, so just double-check that, but it's odysseybks.com, 5 o'clock, Emma Donoghue, Joe Donoghue. What could go wrong? Okay. Then I want to thank our wonderful panel and introduce you to them this morning before we just jump in here and get to all of the stuff that is going on. In keeping with St. Patrick's Day, we are going to talk about the Irish famine later on. So don't want you to get too false a sense of security of things going well. Jim Ketterer is here, senior fellow at Bard Center for Civic Engagement. Good morning, Jim. How are you?
I'm well. Happy to be here.
How much Irish do you have in you? Any?
I have a grandmother who was Irish.
Oh, there you go.
And I'm a proud member of the Ancient Order of Hibernians.
Oh, nice.
Due to that, yeah. I'll be there later tonight having some corned beef and cabbage.
Perfect. Perfect. Yeah. I loaded up on the corned beef this weekend. It was very nice. Good stuff. Judy Patrick is here, Vice President for Editorial Development of the New York Press Association.
I am so Irish.
I was going to say, yeah. You're pretty damn Irish.
That when I was visiting Dublin, people would stop and ask me for directions.
Yeah, you look like a local. Yeah. Right. Especially if you were wearing that sweater.
I'm wearing my Irish sweater. I'm trying to low-key it a little bit today. My Irish grandfather always said St. Patrick's Day was the day to plant peas. And actually, this year, I think I could get out in the garden and plant some peas. So.
Yeah. Well, meaning even here in this climate, too, not in Ireland, in the old country,
as they call it.
Now there is a fascinating connection between where we live in Greenwich, New York, and Ireland, where there was a linen mill, Dunbarton Linen Mill, that was in outside of Armagh, I believe.
Correct.
And then after this famine and horribleness, they moved the entire operations to a very similar area, which was Greenwich, New York. And so was that how your family came here?
Exactly. And my grandfather was 19 years old, and His father had been killed in, you know, the Troubles, and came here as an immigrant. No skills. He went to work in slate quarries up in Granville, but eventually worked at Dunbarton. Yeah, that's you know, a lot of the people in Greenwich in Washington County, those complaining about immigrants today, can trace their roots to immigration from Ireland back in the day.
There's a part of that mill still standing, sort of quasi-standing in the village, but there's a wonderful book, two books actually, that they put out about it. And the history is fascinating. It's really good stuff. Mark Whitman is here, Wall Street investment banker. Any Irish?
So, Joe, here's an interesting story. Last year, I would have told you I was one half Irish. This year, I have to tell you, I am zero Irish. So how does that happen?
Did you lose it in the wash, or what happened?
I was adopted.
Yeah.
In the 60s as a baby. And back then, the records were pretty sparse.
Yeah.
And someone wrote my mother wrote in my baby book that they thought I was one half German, one half Irish.
Which, you know what that does? Makes you a meticulous drunk.
Yeah, exactly. It does a lot of things to you, apparently. Which, by the way, was exactly what my father is, but not my mother. So it would have been an odd. But so it turns out someone found out within the last year a lot about my birth mother, and I am one half German and one half Scottish. Not Irish.
Okay.
So,
all right. Well,
the answer's changed.
Yeah, I think it's close enough. Yeah, but you haven't like spit in a tube or anything.
I haven't, but we're pretty darn sure about the lineage. It's amazing these days what one day of somebody very skilled can do in a record search for you.
Well, it's a thrill to have you all here this morning. Mark brought his son George with us. George, how are you?
I'm good. I'm sad I can't drink the.
Yeah.
About 9 more years. Only 9.
You know, that would be great, like 9 years.
Only
37
nine.
Days. 12 hours. Well, it's not a, you know, it's when you see us after, you'll say, "Oh, that doesn't look as fun as I thought it was going to be."
I thought I was a quarter Irish. Turns out I'm not.
Yeah, well.
Oh, well.
Yeah, oh well. It's really nice to have you here as always. Are you off all week?
Yeah, I'm off till next Tuesday.
Nice. Mm-hmm. Well, it's really good to have you here today. We've missed you and always enjoy your company. So thank you very much for being with us. Let's get to the news of the day. Well, how about that Chuck Schumer? We're going to talk about him for a little bit today. People are mad at Chuck. we talked about this on Friday . There's the spending plan and the continuation of to avert a budget shutdown, and the Republicans pass the bill and the plan, and then at that point they say, well. Go to it, Democrats. If you want, here you go. Now it's your problem. And to overcome the filibuster would have to be so many votes, 60 to be exact. So then that puts a lot of pressure on Chuck Schumer and the minority leader of the Senate. Chuck Schumer then says, "Well, we're not going to deal with that. We're not doing that. That's no, absolutely not. We're not doing." Okay, we're going to do it. All right, we're going to do it. And then at that point, they actually go to the vote, and lo and behold, they have the votes, and it passes, and we go through it. However, what remains is the fight between various factions of the Democratic Party. But of those who say that Democrats should show more resistance, and Chuck Schumer, who we talked about on this show very much, who was between a rock and a hard place in the sense of you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. And it's hard not to, even how you feel about him, not to realize that that is an element of this, that he was saying, what if you... If you don't pass it, that could be worse than if you passed it, which is pretty bad. And he said it is pretty bad. So now this has apparently not only created more dysfunction within the Democratic Party, but it has also created this relationship break between Chuck Schumer and Hakeem Jeffries. And that is yet another problem to this, and element of this, I should say. So the Schumer-Jeffries split exploded in public, and I don't know if exploded is exactly the word, I would say oozed into the public as Hakeem Jeffries was not real helpful in providing cover for Chuck Schumer, and then was asked the question of is he still strong enough to lead the Senate Democrats? And Jeffries said, and gave one of those answers. That wasn't good. So finally, Democrats are calling the Chuck Schumer move ridiculous. They're calling it silly. And a top Democratic official says most in the party are just seething at Chuck Schumer. Mark Whitman.
So, Joe, when it comes to issues around Chuck Schumer, I often, as you know, and I should admit this, I can't see straight. I've been profoundly disappointed in his performance for years. I think all of New York State should be. On this one, I think he got it right. I actually think the battle was lost in the House when the Republicans were able to force when Trump administration were able to force the Republicans to vote for it without any concessions to the Democrats. I think the Republicans in the House are particularly angry because they actually know that's where they lost it. I think Hakeem Jeffries is showing a lack of leadership, which brings into question his ability to continue as the leader in the House. I don't think Chuck Schumer ever had the ability to lead in the Senate. He, for years, rode in the wake of Nancy Pelosi. And there's a Nancy Pelosi, in a weird way, explains why we're so upset today, because in the United States, the party that loses the White House doesn't necessarily have a leader for the next 2 years. But the Democrats, for quite some time, have benefited from Nancy Pelosi's ability to coalesce the party around the principles and the legislative agenda that she proposed. Interestingly enough, she's actually become a Schumer critic as well here. But when the baton passed to Schumer, he was unwilling to do it. He made a profound mistake when he hung Chuckoff's gun on the wall midway through last week and then never used it. But I think the grandstanding among so many, particularly in the House, actually belies the real problems here, which is that's where the maneuvering happened. Now, the when you're the minority, you can't force votes and you can't get by a veto, you have very little legislative power. And I think the Democrats need to be very careful, particularly those in the House, about protesting about how much power they might or might not have. The reason I think this was a mistake, and I had a bow on my conclusions, and I read something by Nate Silver, who I respect a lot, and he said, look, Schumer should have let it fly. He should have taken the risk. People are already unhappy with Trump, and they would have been more unhappy had this happened. The problem is no one can tell me what you would have lost. To let it fly and bet a hand at a betting table, as Nate Silver does, is one thing. But I'll tell you, in finance, you never take a loss that you don't know the depths of. And that's what the Democrats were risking with the shutdown. No one can tell me what the interplay between what Trump's doing and what the courts are doing and what a shutdown would have let them and Doge do. No one could tell me where the bottom to that was. And so you can't look into that abyss and jump down it.
So the argument, and thank you, because that's really very thoughtful of what you just described. The thing that I thought interesting about it was the argument was that if you pass it, then you're giving them a blank check and basically a slush fund to do these different things, and meaning the Republicans and Trump and Musk, and it would allow them to fundamentally change the way that money is allotted and put into use. However, then if you don't pass it, then that means that they can just go roughshod and go nuts. Well, those are sort of the same thing, aren't they?
No, I think the shutdown. So we don't know which of Trump's administrative actions the court's going to dial back, how quickly, when this all starts to get to the Supreme Court and we get definitive answers. And we don't know the damage that will be wrought in the meantime. If you layer on top of that the ability of the administration to then basically control all the spigots until the government was opened back up. The other thing you don't know, and actually John Fetterman, I think, said this really well. I'm going to paraphrase, but he said, you don't enter a war unless you know you're going to win or you know what your exit strategy was. So if all hell hit the fan, to mix a couple metaphors,
yep.
If all hell hit the fan and the Democrats said, this is horrible, we got to dial back, they had no ability to do so. The Republicans could have just kept saying, we love a government shutdown. This works well for us. So I understand that this continuing resolution is worse in terms of affording the administration more flexibility than is typically the case in dealing with funds. But at least you know to some extent what your downside is. And you know that your downside is far less than it might have been in a shutdown case. I think Schumer's not fit to be leader. But in this case, he made the right decision. And I actually think all of the hewing and crying amongst the House brings into question, frankly, Hakeem Jeffries' ultimate ability to be the leader he needs to be.
So let's take a break. When we come back, we'll hear from our other panelists on this topic. We're already getting letters, and we welcome yours. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we welcome you to join in. Already, we've just gotten a few letters, but they're already all over the place, which is interesting. So I think that speaks to the complexity of the issue itself. Judy Patrick and Jim Ketterer get in on the action, and we welcome you right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning, talking about Chuck Schumer and ultimately about his vote that allowed the spending plan to move through and to avert, and we should note this over and over, to avert a shutdown of the federal government, which was set to take place at midnight on Friday night. Judy Patrick.
From my perspective, more about optics than anything else. It's true. Schumer had no good options. And he made a good case for why he decided to go along with this continuing resolution. Although I think he was caught flat-footed. I think he thought the Freedom Caucus in the House would not go along with this and that this continuing resolution would never advance. I don't blame Hakeem Jeffries for that. I blame Schumer for not being in tune with what was happening. That's why he was early in the week saying, yeah, I'm going to shut this down. And then when it being clear that Freedom Caucus was going to go along, that's when he changed course. But overall, what this is doing is degrading the Democratic support among their base. I mean, just look at the local, the most recent polls. Democrats are falling out of. Democrats are disillusioned with their party. They are seeing that the leadership is not providing a convincing case against what's happening in the Trump administration. I mean, just take Schumer himself. What does he do to counteract all the negative press he got on Friday and Saturday? He does an interview with the New York Times. He's selling a book. In the interview with the New York Times, it's just it was not convincing. He's telling us that eventually the public polls will show that the Republicans have no support, and that's when Republican lawmakers will finally turn the tide against Trump and come and see the light and support Democratic principles. Guess what? The tide is turning against the Democrats, and he needs to wake up. The Democrats need to get a better social media presence. I give them a D in this realm. They need to step up their game. A few of them do a fairly good job, but you know, one of them going on and talking about sports is not cutting it. The right wing media and Republican politicians are doing a far better job. So, and I lay that at Schumer's feet. If you listen to his New York Times interview, you can tell he's just not with it.
I do have to say that I was disappointed that, to your point, quick point, that you have NPR was interviewing Chuck Schumer over the weekend, and they said they were doing promos, and they said Chuck Schumer on Morning Edition with Scott Simon. And I was like, oh, that's great.
How timely.
I could listen to that. They're like the man of the hour. I was so proud, you know. And then it's all about the book. It's about he's written a book about anti-Semitism. And so I thought, oh, this is a great opportunity. And then I just – and then I got mad that – I wasn't mad at NPR. I was just mad that wasn't what we needed to hear at that moment. We're not going to talk about the elephant in the room. It's a huge issue, and the book seems to have great merit. I'm not putting that aside. But having Chuck Schumer on a program after this momentous decision and not really being able to talk about it, because I believe the interview was taped on Wednesday and then aired on Saturday, a lot had happened between that time and later. Jim Ketterer.
Well, one thing I just want to point out, in the Jeffries versus Schumer, the House versus the Senate, the House operates under different rules than the Senate. And the place where the Democrats had the most leverage, though not that much, but still had the most leverage, is in the Senate because of the rules that they operate under. And Democratic votes would be needed to pass this to be able to head off a filibuster. So it was clear that Schumer had the strongest hand among weak hands. And, he was trying to balance, is this going to blow back on us, on the Democrats or not? But what he was essentially engaged in is the kind of politics and the political analysis that one would be engaged in normal times. And to say, like, well, we might have to fall back on this. We'll win another fight in the future. That these are the political calculations of being in the situation that we are in both the House and the Senate. However, Chris Murphy from Connecticut was on one of the morning shows yesterday morning, and I thought that he was very strong in saying, these are not normal times. These are not the times in which we need to make these kind of calculations because, number one, we lose whatever hand we have. And number two, we lose sight of the fact of what's really going on here, what's going on well beyond this particular fight over the continuing resolution. And I really recommend that people go find that clip. Murphy was very, very strong in what he was saying. And on the same day that he was saying that, yesterday, I also read a quote from Lee Ballinger, who's the former president of Columbia University, former president of University of Michigan, law school dean, and a scholar, a constitutional scholar. And he is not a wild-eyed radical. And he basically said that what we are seeing here is an authoritarian takeover of the government, piece by piece by piece. And he goes through in detail. But he had in that quote one thing that I thought also aligned with what Murphy was saying, that there is a failure of imagination here. And I've experienced this. I'm talking to people who are good friends, people who are colleagues, people who are very smart and in tune with what's going on. It's hard to wrap one's head around the enormity and the seriousness of the entirety of the challenge that we face with Donald Trump in office and what is happening. And so Chuck Schumer is a product of his times. He's a product of decades of this kind of political analysis of the past. That just doesn't cut it right now. That's not the situation that we're in. And I think that Democrats across the country are going to face continuing pressure from their constituents in the House and in the Senate to say, do something now. And if you're not going to do something, we're going to vote you out. I think Democrats are also maybe going to be facing serious primaries as we get to 2026.
George.
You know, as far as House Democrats go, it's easier to cheer for a suicide mission than to carry one out.
Well, I mean, it seems like everything they do, though, now is a suicide mission, right?
Well, you need 60 votes in the Senate. It's math.
Yeah.
Also, I mean, and you don't have the votes in the House. You need 60 votes in the Senate. And they had some leverage, and they didn't use it. They chose not to use it.
So you think a shutdown would have been better?
You know, I do. I do. And I think that it would have been better if, in fact, it had been then explained in a way. And part of and what Judy's talking about is the inability of Democrats to explain their positions, whether it's the inability to explain the position that Schumer took. I mean, I think the explanation is very lame, even disagreeing with the position. I'd like to hear a better argument or explain the position of voting against the continuing resolution and saying that the Republicans have put something forth that is so radical, so unacceptable, so much a part and parcel of this overall challenge that we're facing in our political system right now. They needed to explain that also in a way. In the absence of being able to explain their positions, I mean, the whole thing is just lost. They might as well have just caved because they're very weak.
Explanations aside, let's say it was shut down. And let's say the Democrats decide we don't like the shutdown. It actually played into Trump's hand for whatever series of reasons. What was their exit strategy, the Democrats?
I think it can't be the explanation aside. The explanation has to be part of it. You can't just say we're going to take a vote and have no explanation. That had to be part and parcel of it all along. And to say, okay, there's going to be, you know, I mean, I worked in the U.S. government during a shutdown. I know what happens during a shutdown. And, there would have been pain, but they would have had to then ramp up their media presence to be able to say this is on the Republicans. This is why this is happening. And in the absence of that, exit strategy, there would be, you know, negotiations over and over again, as there were in 1995 when I worked in government.
But what if through some quirk of a couple of judicial decisions, Musk and Trump decide this is great. It used to take us a day to fire half of the education department. The shutdown's done it for us. We don't have to have them back in the office. And the Democrats decide it wasn't in their interest, and the Republicans decide we like this. It's playing into what we want to do. It's breaking the government, all the rest of it. The Democrats didn't have – I understand the communication issues, and we can all fault the Democrats for that. But there was no exit strategy. Look, in my world, you never place a bet – where you don't know what your losses could
be. So let's go back to history. When there were shutdowns, what was Newt Gingrich's exit strategy when he was playing chicken with Clinton?
So Newt Gingrich, when he shut down, the first shutdown was about healthcare, and they wanted Obama to basically attenuate the funding for the healthcare law.
Clinton.
No. Oh, I'm going back to the
95.
I don't know. That one's...
Okay.
Wait a minute. What about... The last two were the two that I thought Gingrich was involved in those as well. But
so, I mean, the Democrats could have specific things. They could say we need X, Y, and Z, and that could be the exit strategy.
Well,
but I think, again, Mark, that misses the point.
In those cases, they knew the other side didn't want to shut it down, and they had shut it down. So they held the keys as to when it opened back up. So the point is, what if the Republicans decided we love a shutdown? There was no risk the Democrats were going to say, we love this shutdown. It works to our advantage.
I would say this whole need for an exit strategy is engaging in the same sort of pre-2025 political analysis that does not obtain today. I think the Democrats should have said, we're not going to vote for this. We're not going to vote for anything that is driven by this administration. This administration is completely out of control in areas X, Y, and Z, and we are not going to be part of this dismantling of the federal government. And looking for an exit strategy, looking for negotiation points here and there, that's so 2024. That's over. Donald Trump has dismantled this government to the extent that it's a different game now. It's a completely different game.
I understand. You could argue it's a different game, but I would never advise anyone playing a game to take on a loss that you don't know the depths of. Always a bad idea in any era.
Isn't the exit strategy?
Well, what are the losses of doing what he did? So do the same analysis on the strategy that was employed.
We know now that Trump is trying to supersize the power of the administrative branch.
Not trying, doing.
Well, okay, trying, and that in every case, the courts are going to review it and decide where it's technically legal.
They're already
and technically
ignoring
not
court
illegal.
Decisions. They're already ignoring court decisions.
Well, you say they're ignoring.
They are.
They have.
Let's say they have. That's evidence.
They're ignoring court decisions.
They have.
But that gets us into a whole different realm. When you say ignoring,
these are not different realms. These are all connected together.
No. Look, saying to the court, the Andrew Jackson quote, which he never really said, but that the court can force it himself, that's a whole different ball
of
wax.
No, that's not what I'm saying. We have evidence today of ignored court decisions on two deportations where decisions were specifically ignored.
Yeah, okay.
That's not okay.
No, it's not okay, but splitting hairs on, sort of reading the court decisions optimistically as they did with the exportations to the Venezuelans to El Salvador.
Right. Which we'll talk about in a few minutes.
The oopsie.
Yeah, the oopsie stuff. That's sort of playing the lines one way or the other is one thing. But totally saying the court said X and we say Y and thumbing your nose at it, we're not in that realm yet. That's a different realm.
I think we are.
Well, I'll tell you just a little backstage drama here. But during the break before this segment, Jim said, well, I'll keep my powder dry until the segment, and I think it's safe to say the powder is no longer dry. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll go to letters. We'll continue this conversation. We welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll return right after this. Another way of saying it is the panelists have gotten their Irish up. It's the other way of saying it. All right, let's go to some letters, and please feel free, panelists, to jump in. Linda, just look at the Democrat favorability rating. Schumer did the right thing. I'm not aware of that rating.
The rating is pretty low, and this was before the Schumer weekend. So we'll see what the polls say on Tuesday or Wednesday.
Shyla says the normalcy bias describes our tendency to underestimate the possibility of disaster and believe that life will continue as normal, even in the face of significant threats or crises.
Yep. As Lee Ballinger said, a failure of imagination.
We go,
but okay. Can I let's you and Lee Ballinger, if I may. By the way, I get it. Lots of smart people are on either side of this. When I started my work on this, I thought, yeah, Schumer made a mistake because I usually presume he does. But
we start from that.
Yeah. But where is? By the way, if you look at who's on what side of this, it's all in a blender. But what's the So what imaginary thing would you have done in a shutdown to make things better?
No, that's not what Lee Ballinger was talking about. Lee Ballinger was saying, in general, a failure of imagination to really see that what we have underway is an authoritarian takeover of government.
Okay.
That's what he was saying.
All right, thank you for that clarification.
Susan writes, Trump is getting exactly what he wants, and you all are giving it to him on a silver platter, or maybe it should be, in his case, gold. A house divided, pardon the pun, will not stand. Schumer did what he thought he had to protect his country, right or wrong. As fellow patriots, you all should defend his right to make his own choice. You should be decrying the sycophants of Trump's party for their lockstep formation reminiscent of the Nazis in the 1930s. I don't want to speak for our panelists, but I don't think anyone here hasn't done that, but okay. Get your heads in the right place. That's a polite way of saying something else. Now is not the time to tear our Democratic Party apart. Work together against the common enemy. Don't continue to do Trump's work for him.
Can I just say that criticizing the Democratic Party, offering constructive criticism, is a way of being patriotic. And offering constructive criticism to Republicans is a way of being patriotic. Just sitting idly by and saying, the Democratic Party, right or wrong, that is not the way to build a solid, productive, functioning democracy.
Mary says to vote to shut down the government would, to many, have been the best thing to do. Senator Schumer decided it was best for the country to keep government open, although he knew it would be an unpopular decision. That is the definition of a statesman. Jacqueline says, I applaud Chuck Schumer, speaking as the spouse of a federal employee. I applaud Schumer for putting the people's needs ahead of the party's wants. It's a very stressful time for federal employees, and shutting down the federal government for any period of time, regardless of receiving back pay, might be too much for a lot of people to cope with. I understand Jacqueline's point of view, but they could just also just fire them, right? I mean, that's the other thing.
I mean, they are firing them.
Yes.
So it's a stressful time for federal employees. That is certainly true. And I have many friends who have been fired. I have many other friends who have worked on federal programs who have been furloughed probably forever. And so why is it a stressful time for federal employees? Because we have someone in charge of the executive branch who is systematically dismantling the government. And systematically dismantling pieces of the government that he and others that he either admires or is aligned with find to be unpleasant. And so whether it's USAID or Voice of America or the Wilson Center for International Studies, on and on and on, these are dismantled. And so that's why. It's not just randomly that they are feeling under pressure. Is that there is somebody in office who is destroying key parts of our government.
Wyla says, as always, the infighting among the Democrats is at its usual peak. We never learn. Unite. The vote is now over. Unite. Argue less. I'm telling you, ladies and gentlemen, and listeners at large, you would not be as interested if we all agreed. It's time tested. You just wouldn't be.
You know, all those Democrats were lockstep behind Joe Biden for the first half of last year. Oh, he's not that old. He'll do fine. And, you know, they look the other way. And then what happened? So I think raising legitimate concerns is an important part of being a citizen.
The under the subject heading of Democratic leadership is useless, Alan writes, how hard is it to simply stop shielding Trump voters from the consequences of their votes? Michael says, it was my understanding that an emergency needed to be declared for the president to create an executive order. Is this true? If so, what are the emergencies declared under all of these executive orders? Somewhat off topic, but
I don't think that that's the case, that an emergency needs to be declared to issue an executive order. I don't think so.
Yeah, I think if I may, the kernel of truth that I'm aware of in that statement is some of the border measures that have been taken. There is a requirement that there be a national emergency to do what Trump has done, which I and others, including I think the Washington Post or maybe the Journal, the Wall Street Journal, have asked the question. It was the Wall Street Journal asked the question, why the heck aren't we in court calling bogus on what Trump did on immigration?
I think the ACLU is on many of those things. And I think that has to do with the military, the U.S. military getting involved in the border. And I think that's where the emergency has to be declared, I think.
Kathy says, here's the thing. If Schumer was wrong, then he was wrong. If he was right, he did a miserable job communicating it. Yeah. Either way, not a good leader. That from Kathy. Then we...
By the way, when Hakeem Jeffries was particularly upset because he was blindsided, and that goes back to the Chekhov's gun thing. I mean, when Schumer sort of had everybody thinking he was going to oppose it, and they started to lean into that, and then Schumer threw a left hook. That was a huge... Again, in Chuck Schumer style... If you're going to do it right, make sure you do it right the wrong way, and if you can.
You know, even D.C. Robin eventually becomes Nightwing. Chuck Schumer just can't leave without Nancy Pelosi.
Is that Marvel?
It's D.C.
It's D.C. Okay.
All right. That's D.C.
That's D.C. Not Washington, D.C., just D.C. All right, got it. Then Matthew says, only the American people can oppose MAGA. It's beyond Congress at this point. We have another letter, and I sort of agree with this point, but I know it's trite. Not to say the letter writer is trite, but, you know, the exit strategy is an election, right? I mean, that's sort of the ultimate exit strategy that we've been talking about, is that's when the change is made. But you have to wait 2 years to do it. Okay. Then... Yes.
but you have to win the election, too.
That's right.
Yeah, to Mark's point, you might put yourself in a position where you would weaken your hand to be able to win those elections.
Great description of the dangers of not knowing the downside risk of a bet as an explanation of Chuck Schumer's actions. As you said, this isn't Nate Silver's punditry. It isn't a financial bet either, but that's a closer parallel. This is more real and more implant than either punditry or finance, and that from Deborah. Then we go to Vincent. If Schumer's reasoning is sound, it should have been a coordinated message with House Democrats to say that Trump and House Republicans were holding the country hostage with their bill and adding to the mounting assault of the American people, and were only voting for it as the lesser of two evils. Mike says the current crisis with the Democratic Party leadership is indicative of how absolutely bereft of a future centrism is. Let's be clear, centrism is an ideology. Schumer, Pelosi, Biden, Obama have functioned to pay lip service to progressivism while suppressing its purchase. The final nail in the coffin, it's time for the Dems to realign back to the left. If Sanders initiated a dirty break today, I, for one, would be on board. Mickey says, do you think Schumer voted to keep the government to take the bullet for the Dems? It was an unpopular but seemed necessary decision to keep the government open. Schumer will get primary now and ride off into the sunset. And then we go to Kat, finally, before a break. Mark Whitman's observations on Senator Schumer are spot on. This was lost in the House because the Democratic Party is so severely weakened. The Democratic Party needs to focus on what went wrong to get the party to this tragic point. Focusing on Senator Schumer is a cop-out to the real problem.
Can I just say, it was lost in the House because they don't have the numbers. That's the problem. You have to do the math. They don't have the numbers. But they have leverage even in the minority in the Senate because of the rules.
So we'll pause there. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about other uplifting things. And we always welcome you to the conversation. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Jim Ketterer is here, Senior Fellow, Bard Center for Civic Engagement, Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick, and Wall Street investment banker Mark Whitman, who is here with his son, George. And we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. The Trump administration denied on Sunday that it had violated a court order by deporting hundreds of Venezuelan immigrants to a prison in El Salvador over the weekend, saying that the president had broad powers to quickly expel them under an 18th century law meant for wartime. The White House press secretary also asserted in a statement that the federal courts, quote, have no jurisdiction over the president's conduct of foreign affairs or his power to expel foreign enemies. Quote, this from Catherine Levitt, quote, a single judge in a single city cannot direct the movements of an aircraft carrier full of foreign alien terrorists who were physically expelled from U.S. soil, she said in a statement. It was unclear why she referred to an aircraft carrier, because all indications were that the Venezuelans had been flown to El Salvador. While White House officials exulted over what they see as a precedent-setting victory in their efforts to speed up deportations, the comments also tacitly acknowledge that the court battles over their legal rationale may just be beginning. President Trump signed an executive order on Friday invoking the Alien Enemies Act of 1798 to rapidly arrest and deport those the administration identifies as members of a gang without many of the legal processes common in immigration cases. The enemy's law allows for summary deportations of people from countries at war within the United States. On Saturday, Judge James Boasberg A federal district court in Washington used a temporary restraining order blocking the government from deporting any immigrants under the law after Mr. Trump's order invoking it. Jim Ketterer.
So, yeah, that comment from the press secretary that basically just says we don't have to follow any court orders. This is leading us down a path that constitutional scholars have been worried about even before Trump took office. And now since he's been in office and there's been this flurry of executive orders and a flurry of lawsuits and a flurry of court decisions. And basically people have been warning that we are leading up to a major constitutional crisis when the administration says we're simply not going to follow court orders. And because what is the enforcement capacity for following court orders? It is calling out the marshals who report to the Department of Justice. And so if the president says, marshals, do not come out, do not enforce these court orders, that would really be the absolute moment of constitutional crisis. Right now, they're just saying they're not going to follow the court orders. It appears they have, in both this case and in the case of the doctor from Brown University who was coming back into the country and was deported, as somebody who holds an H-1B valid visa. There was also a court order to not do that, and it was done. So I think this is just another sign of the seriousness of the entire situation. And, you know, there have been others who have said, well, you know, it was so close and maybe they didn't get the order in time. And we have the president of El Salvador saying, oopsie, and being cutesy about it. This is not cutesy. This is really very serious business as it relates to the entirety of the actions of the executive branch vis-a-vis the judicial system. They already essentially have the legislative branch captured. They have many appointees from the first Trump administration who are willing to do their bidding. But for judges who are going to rule against them to simply say, we're going to ignore those orders, you know, buckle up, ladies and gentlemen. We are really in for some serious times.
And the reason the judges are ruling against the Trump administration is the issue of due process. And there are plenty of people that can speak to the fact that we are a nation of laws and how people are entitled to a hearing before a judge. But I want to talk a little bit about the lack of transparency in all of this. I mean, our courts are the Trump administration is operating in the dark. That apparently Trump signed this on Friday night, unbeknownst to other people. I mean, the administration is not being frank and forthright with the American public about what they're doing. We don't know the names of the people who were deported. We don't know what their accusations against them. I mean, that as well as with a Colombian student who is in custody in Louisiana. The lack of accountability in terms of being transparent about what they're doing, why they're doing, and the specific details of to justify what they're doing, it's gone. And the press is struggling so hard to keep up with the pace of information that we're not even making that case anymore. And we do need to continue to press for the information because it's not there. They don't have a solid justification for what they're doing.
George.
He's just abusing the law now. I mean, this has existed since 1812, right? And nobody's used it when we're not at war. Yeah. And there's reason to worry about how young these kids are. I mean, some of them are about 14, I think.
Yeah, some of them left.
And, well, when have we invoked this? In the War of 1812, World War I, World War II. And not this guy again.
Yeah, look, I think there are a number of issues intertwined here. One is the optics. When you say Trump wants to look like he's being harsh. And this was, by the way, these folks were supposed to be sent to Guantanamo Bay, and that's not working out. So now they've figured out another place that's optically even as palatable to the Republicans and their base. The cruelty of it, should give us all pause. It smacks of when the UK started to talk about sending irregular immigrants to Rwanda and have them processed and potentially become citizens of Rwanda when they enter after they had entered the UK. It should give us all pause. I do think it's a clear abuse of the legal power that they found on the shelf and they're misapplying. I do believe it underscores one sin that's been committed by many administrations going back to, I think it was LBJ who declared a war on poverty. I think we ought to use that term a lot more lightly than we do in this country. And I think the risks of what Trump is doing by declaring this a war or a conflict with a terrorist group as guise for what he's doing is true. I also think it underscores the importance of the courts. I don't think we're at a constitutional crisis yet. I think this is like a hockey game where lots of things are prohibited and you see sort of conduct that's on the line or close to the line. So the oopsie comment that, by the way, was retweeted or re-X'd by Marco Rubio, which is just horrible.
Our chief diplomat.
Yeah, well, he's supposed to be. I wouldn't call him that any longer. I would say he's supposed to be our chief diplomat. I think that's really unconscionable that he would do that. It shows how quickly, by the way, that your morals get captured once you're in that Trump orbit, right? We all thought, I mean, how many senators voted for him? Would they today? No way, right? Mm-hmm.
And they're saying that.
Oh, I'm sure they are. I mean, any reasonable person would. I they're playing close and fast the line. I don't think they've incurred the, you know, Andrew Jackson let the court enforce it itself penalty yet. But I do think they're playing close and fast to the line because they want to accelerate the rate at which this gets to the Supreme Court. And I think that's going to be the true test is how many of those six conservatives on the Supreme Court are going to stand up. And they are going to be very important in determining how much of a functioning and responsible democracy we have left at the end of these 4 years.
Jim?
Well, I think the in terms of the optics, you know, I think that the Trump administration was very much convinced that by sending people who are said to be gang members, that this would play well, not only to their base, but in general, people would say, well, you know, these seem like bad guys and maybe they need to be sent out somewhere. To Judy's point, you know, due process exists for a very good reason, and it exists to ensure that people who are, in fact, being detained by the United States, shipped somewhere else, you know, that there's some legal foundation for this. And due to lack of transparency and lack of due process, we have no idea. We really, truly have no idea. And then in some of these other cases, the transplant surgeon from Brown, not just Mahmoud Khalil, but another Columbia student who has been arrested and another who had fled to Canada as ICE was looking for her and, you know, had been caught up in a protest at Columbia a year ago when she wasn't even involved in the protest and the charges were dismissed against her. Mahmoud Khalil, he has a green card, and when they came to get him, they weren't even aware of that. And they said, "Your student visa has been revoked." And he said, "I have a green card." And they said, "Well, we're gonna take you anyway." This is on the facts of it for these specific cases, it's troubling, but the overall implication and that statement by the White House press secretary that says out loud, judges really have no power here. No power over any foreign policy issue, anything to do with anything outside the United States. These are decisions by the executive branch, and she's saying the judges have no power over this. That's very troubling. That in normal times, that press secretary would be relieved of their duties immediately. But these are not normal times. They are applauded.
There was a point where if you had said, this is an issue that needs to go to the court, we'll fight it in court and we'll see what happens and where we go from there.
Right.
Different from the judges are wrong and we're going to do what we want to do anyway.
Yes. And then the right-wing media ecosystem then naming these judges and sort of dragging them into the noonday sun to ensure that they are going to incur the wrath of the mob.
Yeah.
And we should just zoom back to the headline here. For all the cruelty of Tom Homan and Marco Rubio and Donald Trump, it's not clear that the rate of deportation from this country is any higher than it was under the Biden administration. So imagine what we've got. You know, if they really want to make the base happy on the Trump side of the world, you've done all this. You've gone through all these optics and all this cruelty and all this playing with the edges of the law, and you've gotten for it in practice absolutely nothing in terms of your real objective.
For sure.
You know, this questioning of judicial authority is starting to percolate up through social media. I saw it all over yesterday where people who were Trump supporters saying, what right does a judge have to tell our president what to do? I mean, it harkens back to the old Rush Limbaugh days because during his tenure, he was always questioning judicial authority until the right got control of the judicial branch of government, and then they changed their tune a bit. But I am seeing this all over. People have a basic misunderstanding of how laws work and how our balance of power works, and I see them going to be there supporting President Trump if he defies a court order.
And, you know, Judy, what is really troubling is that basic misunderstanding is supported by the leadership of the country and is encouraged. And that Joe was saying in previous times, people would say, well, we'll fight this in court and we'll appeal this all the way up to the Supreme Court and we'll see where it goes. But that's very different than saying they simply don't have a right to have any say over these actions.
And to your point, I mean, I feel it's important to mention Amy Coney Barrett, I think you brought up here, but, you know, just being hoisted up as the devil for having the gall to go against the president that put her in that position. How dare she?
Well, let's talk about look, there are smart people on the conservative side, and let's talk through what they're thinking and what I believe Roberts and Amy Koenig Barrett are already doing the calculus around. This is going to get to the Supreme Court. Something is going to get to the Supreme Court, and there's going to be a time at which the Supreme Court has to say to Donald Trump, you got to stop. And if you remember, a stitch in time saves nine, it is not incomprehensible that the Supreme Court will decide which issue to pick and which decision to come down on in a way that makes it less likely we will face a constitutional crisis. So right now, I guarantee you, whether they are explicitly saying it to each other or not, Roberts and Koenig Barrett are sitting there trying to figure out which battle they're going to pick first when they have to draw this line. And part of that is because they are well aware of the Trump base and the risks that they face both with the Trump base as well as the administration's potential willingness or the risk that they're willing to do the Andrew Jackson snub the court. So, I mean, there are people playing this game five steps ahead already today. And I think the Trump playing the lines quick, playing the fuzzy lines on this deportation to Venezuela, I mean, aside from the cruelty and the rest of it, what can't be lost is they're trying to accelerate that moment they get to the Supreme Court and call this question.
Kevin writes, didn't the Biden administration disregard the Supreme Court's decision on forgiving student loans? Precedent was set on the Democratic watch. They paved the road to ignore judges' rulings on the highest level.
What they did with the student loans was they stopped doing what the judge or what the court ordered them to do, but they devised another plan to get around it, which eventually could have been challenged as well. But I think they just did it a different way. There's some legitimacy to that. But again, they tried a whole different way. I think the initial court order was the fact that it was a too broad based approach to eliminating that student debt. And so what the Biden administration did was they were more selective.
We go to Marilyn, who says there is a huge difference between deporting people to their home country and shipping people to a third country, which is being paid to imprison those people in some horrible gulag condition. Are these not crimes against humanity? Then we go to Joan. Videos on social media show those deported forced to their knees while shackled, having their hair and beards forcibly shaved while surrounded by heavily armed men. These people never receive due process and are only accused of crimes. Then we go to Richard. It should be clear to everyone that when a government empowers agents to detain folks in the street and to ship them away without due process on the unsubstantiated grounds that they are, quote, illegal aliens, the procedure can be used to detain and disappear any politically inconvenient opponent. There are tens of thousands of people in places like Argentina, Brazil, and Chile who have no idea what became of their relatives or even who took them away decades ago. The governments have never released comprehensive records of who they were and why they were taken. People who regard this as an issue related only to immigrants or international students or holders of H-1B visas are kidding themselves. That from Richard.
Joe, can I also just mention that George had pointed out quite accurately that one of the precedents for the use of this Alien Enemies Act is the imprisonment of Americans of Japanese descent during World War II in one of the most shameful periods in our history. And so to, you know, for this administration to build on that and to use this same law, to use Mark's phrase, it ought to give us pause, to put it mildly.
Sarah writes, presidents do not declare war. Only Congress may do so. Then we, what's going
though
on?
That's been violated many, many times.
Yes.
But yes, that's the Constitution, that quaint thing called the Constitution.
Larry says, dear panel, it is time for state governors who oppose tyranny to assemble and tell the world that the Federation is broken. The president ignores the law. The three branches do not work together. The Constitution is a dead letter. The power of the sovereign states must be turned to.
Is that a quote from the just before the Civil War?
It sounds
like a Confederate battle cry.
I don't think it was a quote, but you know,
that one gives me pause. It's because if you insert the Confederate said, you could read that same quote for word and be happy with the. I mean, happy in terms of it would sound in context.
Yes,
I've heard versions of that quite a lot over the last few weeks, and on one hand, I think it's, aside from the constitutional issues, it's calling for governors to be more active, particularly in the absence of the Democrats in the Congress being effective. And some governors have stepped up and done that, and many have not. But that's the sort of thing that I have also seen in other places around the world where I have worked. And again, with the failure of imagination, we tend to think that, you know, that these things couldn't possibly be thought of, be happening, be conceived of in the United States. And as things increasingly become a crisis, whether it happens or not is a different story, but I think we'll hear more and more of that kind of sentiment. As crazy as it might sound, I think it's the sort of thing that builds us toward a crisis from which we just can't come back from.
You know, now would be a great time perhaps for Democratic leadership to be a little bit more forceful about their criticism of the Trump administration. You hear a little bit once in a while, but you're not hearing, they're not out there pounding the pavement saying how outrageous this is. And so it seems like it's a lost opportunity.
We go to two letters here before our break. Carrie writes, I know the Supreme Court has ruled that the president cannot be prosecuted for any crimes while in office, but what about the people who execute his illegal orders? Can all the people that do things for him be prosecuted eventually? Wouldn't this deter many people in the federal government from doing Trump's bidding? That from Carrie. And then Gail says, now you're getting there. We need to envision what citizens can do. It's time to figure out what our options are beyond the courts. Nationwide work stoppage initiated by the people. Nationwide demonstrations. Impeaching the president. Demanding Musk's deportation. Finding any cabinet members or Republicans with a conscience who will use the 25th Amendment. Other suggestions? Pray.
Open that bottle of bourbon.
Yeah. The bourbon is here.
We need to keep the conversation going. You need to talk to people. You need to listen to what other people are saying, people of different perspectives than you. You need to support the media. You need to be aware of what's happening. You can't tune out. I would have loved to tune out this weekend and just go outside and rake. But I felt like it was important to stay in tune. You have to be, even Saturday night, you had to stay tuned.
Yeah, absolutely.
We
have to take a break, right. But then you hold that thought, and we'll get right back to it in just a moment after this news from the BBC. Such delightful music from such an angry place. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion, St. Patrick's Day 2025. We're here, and we love hearing from you. Let's see. We two letters, and then we'll move on to other subjects. We're taking it to 11 o'clock. You had a point. I apologize, Mark. I forgot.
That's okay. I'll let you, if I may. I appreciate a lot of the last letter writer's sentiments, but one thing I would request, and at the risk of being too much of a purist, Elon Musk is a naturalized U.S. citizen. So let's stop with the – we cannot like what he's doing. We cannot like Teslas and all the rest of it, but let's stop with the let's deport him nonsense. I just think that sounds bad. And if I may, the other one I don't like, and somebody I forget where this came from, but not from me originally. When we talk about Donald Trump – let's talk about him as a person who's been convicted of felonies, but not a felon, because I think defining people based on that one act is a thing we wouldn't do for lots of others we know. There are lots of ways to dislike what's happening and even to dislike the people who are engaged in these activities, but let's be careful about how we do that.
Can I note that the person convicted of a felony is now deciding what laws he can follow and what laws he cannot?
No, I get all that. I think it was the Brennan Center for Justice who said,
yes.
I don't like it because I work with lots of people who are reclaiming their lives, and they were convicted of felons, but let's not call them – they were convicted of felonies, but let's not call them felons. I think we do a disservice – when we're sloppy, my wife is a film professor, and one thing that she said that one of the professors taught her was, it's great to hate movies, but you have to learn how to hate better.
Right. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
And to be consistent.
Bill writes to us and says, during the 2016 presidential campaign, Alan Chartok was criticized when he compared Trump to Hitler. He was a voice crying out in the desert of the "it can't happen here" world. Indeed. Then we go to Bob. Okay. You guys have scared the bejesus out of us. But you offer no strategies to defeat this takeover. Well, that's not really our job to, like, support whatever moving forward. However, we can inform you as to what's going on, and then stir, mix, and enjoy on your own watch. There are two special elections in Florida, one in New York coming up. Flipping those seats should be our priorities. The midterms are too far away. That from Bob.
And one thing I would say to Bob is that the first part of taking this seriously is to just have an understanding of what's really happening. And so I think that's what we're talking about today. But I think he offers some important next steps.
Absolutely.
In terms of the electoral cycle.
That's sure. Right. And three elections that are coming up that even whether we may or may not be in those districts, we can certainly take part if we are so inclined. So let's go to another topic. My buddy Mark Whitman sent me a really cool opinion piece from the Financial Times over the weekend, and we thought we would talk about it because it is something that we have discussed on and off in the program over the last several weeks, especially with the stock market and the markets in general bouncing all over the place. So the Financial Times opinion piece is titled, Trump's Incoherent Economic Agenda. It now appears that neither a slowing economy nor plunging stock prices are enough to deter U.S. President Donald Trump from his radical economic agenda. Beyond promising to buy a Tesla to prop up the beleaguered stock of Elon Musk's enterprise, he is in fact doubling down. Asked about the economic and market turbulence, the self-proclaimed tariff man argues that a period of transition may be necessary as his administration brings wealth back to America, quote unquote. It is a detox period, according to Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent. The cleanse has so far raised the specter of stagflation, wiped $5 trillion off the S&P. Is that true?
At the point the article was written, it was true, yes.
Yes, off the S&P 500 and undermined the nation's standing with global investors. Mark.
Joe, the reason I liked the article was because there's all this market turmoil. And as I've said many times on the program, the stock market in the short run reacts to or is a product of emotions and expectations. And that's what you're seeing. And it's actually not down all that much. I think it may be a net of 10% after an incredible historic run-up. So I think you have to put the recent retreat of the stock market in historical context in order to understand that not that much wealth has been lost, particularly if you look at a intermediate or longer term lens. But I do think it's important to understand why the markets are reacting the way they are. And I thought the Financial Times article encapsulated a lot of contradictions, right? Trump says that he wants tariffs to raise revenues, but he also wants companies to move production to the U.S., which would decrease tariff income. He says that he wants to push for U.S. energy independence, even though, by the way, that's an oasis. But he wants oil prices to fall, energy prices to fall dramatically, which would make domestic drilling unprofitable, right? At the same time, he says he wants a weaker dollar for exports. But officially, the administration is still calling for a stronger dollar. Also, he's talking about the tax cuts to boost growth, but all that they're doing now in terms of the economic policy is leading to uncertainty, which delays investment and dampens market sentiment. And there are a whole bunch of these contradictions that the administration is postulating sort of both sides of the same coin. So it is no wonder that the financial markets are at best puzzled. And at the same time we're doing this, we've actually made foreign stock markets great again, witnessed the rise in Germany and in other countries that was in large part led by their defense industry. Because if the United States is no longer going to be leading the defensive umbrella for Europe, the Europeans are going to have to do it themselves. And capital has rushed into particular companies in Europe that are going to benefit from that. Also, the one thing that Trump has done financially is when he said that he had a great call with Vladimir Putin, the Russian stock market recovered dramatically. So make other stock markets great again ought to be one of the adages that this administration is using. And I just thought that that article encapsulating those contrasts in what Trump is doing was a great and straightforward explanation for why the markets are in such turmoil. The one thing I will caution is there may well be a slowdown in the U.S. economy, but our economy now is so large and so diverse that if there were a quote-unquote recession, I think it would be relatively shallow and relatively short-lived. The global economy has only gone into a recession. Recession is defined by negative per capita output 5 times, and it's all around these big, it's around COVID, the financial crisis, the oil embargo. Since about 1950, I think it's 5 times it's gone globally. And the U.S. is such a huge part of the global economy now that I think we're relatively insulated from what we would have seen, say, prior to 1950 in terms of deep, difficult recessions. So if you're rooting against the economy because it's going to be a check on Trump, I think there are natural breaks given how diversified we are. But I think the market turmoil in response to what are conflicting pronouncements by the administration is very likely to continue.
Well,
that was me trying to say Jim Ketterer and not being able to summon the vocal cords to actually
believe me.
Start.
I've grown up with this name. It's a mouthful.
No,
Ketterer, a lot of syllables.
It was fine. It wasn't the name. It was just getting everything, getting the motor started in my throat. Go ahead.
All right. You know, you had just mentioned. I think it's Scott Bessent who said that we have to detox the economy, and so. What does that really mean? What has exactly has to be detoxed? I mean, Trump, as he did before and in his campaign for 2016 and as he did more recently, said we have to drill, baby, drill. And he talks about, you know, reviving the American petroleum sector. We were already an exporting petroleum sector. He's upset that a large amount of Canadian oil that comes to the United States, but had argued vigorously for the pipeline that brings that oil. So the as you said, Mark, you know, the contradictions, the inconsistencies, just the ignorance just goes on and on and on. I think the only antidote to it is to ask for specifics, demand specifics, look for specifics, and if getting no answer from the White House, then trying to get answers from members of Congress and saying, like, what specifically is the goal here? What is the end result that is desired? Because the chaos beyond the pronouncements, but the actual chaos in policy is having so many deleterious effects. I can't understand for the life of me what the expected end result is supposed to be. Even if I were to disagree with it, I'd love to hear an articulation of it to try to at least argue against it. It just seems chaotic and ignorant.
Right. The White House is failing to communicate their economic strategy, but apparently it doesn't matter to their base. All they look at, I mean, during the Biden administration, I didn't hear anything on social media about how the price of gas was going down. Now that it's gone down a couple of cents since Trump took office, I hear about it all the time. It's very selective in terms of what people are seeing and what they don't. And let's not talk about, you know, eggs. It's the bird flu. The egg prices will come down. We'll be making omelets in no time. But in terms of, you know, in my industry, the newspaper industry, we're facing a 25% tariff on newsprint coming from Canada, which is going to be, it could be devastating for papers that continue to print. And the papers that continue to print are often those local small papers that are doing, you know, the local reporting that is building trust in our government and our institutions. It's not like tariffs are unheard of. During the Biden administration, Biden had a 10% tariff on aluminum, and that involved the plates we use to print the newspapers. And so, is there going to be a tariff from Canada or not? Newspapers right now don't know. They don't know how to build those costs into, you know, the price they charge their advertisers and their subscribers. So, in my small industry, it's a big deal.
We will take a break. When we come back, we'll finish up and have our last words from our panel this morning. We always welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back. Hello, good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this St. Patrick's Day. We have a couple of letters, and then we'll see what other trouble we can get into before we end our time together in the next 10 minutes. Joanne writes, how concerned should we be that if we take to the streets or push back in large numbers, the president will declare martial law and thereby seal his fate as a dictator? Is it possible that he's just waiting for this to happen?
When I saw the piece that was retweeted by Musk about the fact that Derek Chauvin might be eligible for a pardon. Remember, Chauvin is the gentleman who was convicted on overwhelming scientific evidence that he murdered George Floyd. And he was convicted in Minnesota State Court. I read that as a potential. I basically saw that and I said, gee, you can't rule out the possibility that at least the Republicans in the administration are hoping to foment so much dissent at some point that they that they're permitted a very extreme reaction to it. I don't know that I want to define what I think the parameters on that reaction are, but I do think we as a nation need to be mindful of a potential reaction, which is different than saying I don't think there's going to be times at which we ought to take to the streets.
I think we ought to take seriously the fact that in the first administration, the first Trump administration, he did bring up the idea of shooting protesters.
In the legs.
In the legs, but using the military to shoot protesters, and was talked out of it by the then Secretary of Defense. I also think that we ought to take seriously the fact that when he removed the leadership at the Pentagon, he also removed the leadership of the legal part of the military, the JAGs, the Judge Adjutant Generals of each of the services. And those would be the areas where they would question the legality of things. And so the last thing I would say on this subject is if you look at the trajectory of other types of governments that appear to be going in this direction, one of the things that does happen is exactly what Mark said, which is to try to create an incident where then there is a crackdown, there is a use of force that is so chilling to people, and it's all done under the heading of reestablishing law and order. It's not done to be seen as just chaotic, but it says, like, we are on the side of law and order. So I do think that it's a real concern.
Anybody else? Okay.
Well, there's a great article in the Financial Times likening Trump and his administration to strongmen in Latin America, and actually says more than sort of the other dictators that are often mentioned. That's a better parallel, and I would recommend that people dig that up and take a look. It's very insightful, and it does sort of circle the risks that we face in this country.
Ken writes, I heard somewhere on a WAMC broadcast within the last month that some hedge fund managers were betting that Trump would tank the market. What are the chances that this is a scheme to short the market so that billionaire investors can make further billions? Would this be taking place in the futures markets?
I guess with Trump, I wouldn't rule out anything, frankly. I do know that the smart money in the markets a while ago wasn't betting up or down. It was betting that volatility would increase. Believe it or not, you can actually trade volatility. And the better bet of about a month ago was to bet on volatility increasing. And, you know, if this were any other administration, I would say, well, of course, investors aren't in cahoots with the administration. You can't say this with these folks.
Yeah, you know, we just have to keep the conversation elevated. You can't descend into, you know, name calling and tit for tat discussions on social media. If we just keep plugging away, I know this sounds naive, but I think that's our only option, to keep plugging away at what the real facts are, what the real news is, and don't resort to name calling and mean-spirited exchanges. I just think that's the only way forward.
We're getting a lot of letters about the refraining from calling Trump a felon. I just wanted to make that.
Can I just say that convicted felon is redundant? A felon, by definition, is convicted of a felon.
It has been convicted. So. Okay. Okay, quick. We have 5 minutes. Quick. Canadians and other international visitors are scrapping U.S. travel plans. As according to the Washington Post, international tourists are canceling plans to visit the U.S. with Canadians leading the way. And this is obviously a lot of tumult that comes. The Trump administration's hard stance on tariffs and other international policies has some travelers rethinking where they vacation, with the United States no longer on their list of places to go. The Washington Post says that this all seems wobbly. They're skipping trips to Disney World and music festivals. Europeans are eschewing U.S. national parks, and Chinese travelers are vacationing in Australia instead. International travel to the United States is expected to slide by 5% this year, contributing to a 64 $1 billion shortfall for the travel industry, according to Tourism Economics. The research firm had originally forecast 9% increase in foreign travel, but revised its estimate late last month to reflect polarizing Trump administration policies and rhetoric.
Can I tell you, I went out of the country and back into the country with a couple from France. And getting back into the country just a week or two ago was incredibly difficult. I mean, they were not welcomed with open arms. I, for one, am planning a summer trip to Canada because it's a beautiful country to visit. Their parks are wonderful. Let's hope that I can reinvigorate some goodwill of Americans by going up there and enjoying Toronto, Quebec City, Montreal. Great places to visit.
Well, later this week, I'm going to give a couple of talks in Florida, and one afternoon, I'm going to go to a spring training game, which I've never been to, but I'm going to a Toronto Blue Jays game, and I'm very interested to see who's there, and I'm very interested to see how people will be reacting to the playing of O Canada.
So, do you want me to give it away?
Yeah, please.
Okay, so 2 weeks ago, I was in... So the Philadelphia Phillies were playing the Toronto Blue Jays. They had both the national anthem, the Canadian national anthem, and the American national anthem. They were both performed by the same individual. And the crowd that I saw, the capacity, 11,000 people, were extremely, extremely supportive of both anthems.
Okay.
So there was no booing. There was no, or if there was, I didn't hear it. The overwhelming, it was very supportive on both sides.
Well, this is in line with Judy's call for civility and
yes.
engagement. So,
and I will also say, I mean, I do think, and I was thinking about this too, is that like in the case of where you're going, I mean, that's still their local team too, though. Yes, it's Canada, but it's mm-hmm. also their local team, and that's the team that they're going to be rooting for. So I think that has an element to it, but I was worried like when I sat down and they started the anthem, so I was like, oh boy, here we go, oh boy, and that was fine. And I was like, okay, good, that's a good thing. We just have a minute or so. Here's a letter from Rita. Joe, as an Irish woman living in America and Albany, I say we should declare George Young Irish Man of the Day. In a world fraught with such doom and gloom, George is a breath of fresh air. Keep up the good work, George. Maybe one day you will decide to run for President of the United States. I personally think you can do better.
Thank you.
A very happy St. Patrick's Day to all from Rita. Very nice way to end our time together. Jim Ketterer, thank you very much. Always very nice to have
happy
you
to be here.
Be well. Judy Patrick.
Bagasham Bagora, happy St. Patrick's Day to you.
Have a beautiful day. Enjoy. And Mark Whitman, thank you very much for you being here. Thank you for bringing George along. You'll be here later in the week.
Happy St. Patrick's Day to everyone.
All right. We'll see you later. My thanks to all. We'll be back right after this.